Hey listeners, if you love The Santhro Life and you want to support the show, Anchor.fm makes it super easy to do. They give you options to donate $1, $5, or $10 on a monthly basis. Whatever you choose to support us with, we're grateful to have you, and it's going to help us produce better and better content.
And now, on to the show. Hey everybody, welcome to This Anthro Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And this is Ryan Collins. As always, This Anthro Life is brought to you in part through collaborations with the American Anthropological Association, the Society for Applied Anthropology, Sapiens, and we have a new announcement with Savage Minds coming up. Adam, do you want to handle that?
Yeah, we're really excited to let you know we have a five-part series coming up. This is a first-ever crossover between This Anthro Life and Savage Minds. And if you don't know Savage Minds, you absolutely should. They're an amazing anthropology blog. They have a ton of authors, different people that come in, and they, like us, are interested in writing for lay audiences, for anthropologists, for everybody, trying to share the anthropological imagination and how we might think about the world in cultural, social ways, put biological things in perspective, put archaeology in perspective. Really a great blog community. So we are partnering up with them, and we're going to offer you this really cool through the month of June five-part series where we are going to have conversations on public anthropology, what it is, what it isn't, what we want it to be, what other people want it to be. And we're going to be talking with some of the authors from Savage Minds, people from the American Anthropological Association, the Society for American Archaeology, Sapiens, the awesome new journal. And we'll do kind of a follow-up episode with us, just TAL, talking about our perspective on public anthropology.
And we'll also be talking with writers from Forbes and writers from various different blog posts as well. So this is going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. So we're super excited to let you know about that. That'll be coming out next month. And we are working furiously to get that ready for you guys.
Right. So today is going to be a great podcast episode. We've already recorded it, and we know it's going to be excellent. We're here with Dr. Anita Hannig talking about the writing process. And with that, we should dive into it.
All right. So today we are joined by Dr. Anita Hannig, assistant professor at Brandeis University. She has a new book out. We're going to talk about it today. It's called Beyond Surgery, Injury, Healing, and Religion at an Ethiopian Hospital. It came out just last month in April 2017. It's from the University of Chicago Press. And so we want to invite Anita to join us today to kind of talk about the craft of writing and what it means to sit down and what the process looks like, what it feels like to write, writing for anthropology, writing for different kinds of audiences. And so we thought this was a perfect time. It's a great new book. Super interesting if you're interested in anything about medicine or religion or healing, things that matter to most of us in the world, I think. So Anita, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's really exciting to talk about the craft of writing, since all of us are doing some form of writing right now. I mean, Adam and I are writing our dissertations, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, depending on the day. But Anita, you've also just completed this book. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your experiences putting this together.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe just to say a couple of things about the book itself.
For sure.
So the book takes place inside two clinical institutions in Ethiopia that are dedicated to treating women who suffer from a condition called obstetric fistula. An obstetric fistula is a maternal childbirth injury that leads to chronic incontinence. And it's quite common, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where women don't have access to a C-section always in the event of obstructed labor. Mm-hmm. And the book really takes on the classic narrative that a Western audience has been told about this condition. And that narrative essentially suggests that fistula sufferers become these horribly despised outcasts of their community who are abandoned by their husbands and kin on account of their incessant leaking, only then to be saved by surgery. And the book really tries to expose the underlying assumptions behind this narrative and really unravels the complex ways that women with fistula navigate their condition. And so it also really complicates the popular idea of surgical salvation. And so I guess also in the process, I think we learn a lot about the work of care, belonging, loss, medicine, and faith. And I try to really write this book in a lucid, accessible language, trying to reach academics, health practitioners, and a lay audience. But I also found out how tricky that is and how tricky it is to kind of speak to so many different audiences kind of in one book.
Yeah. Well, that made me think, I mean, because it's an interesting piece, because even the idea of trying to write for a lay audience backwardly and quietly says then these books traditionally as an anthropology or an academic text are not written for lay audiences, right?
Right.
And that's something that we try to do in TAL also, is to try to speak in this sort of lucid sense or a way that if we can communicate by conversation or even write in a certain way, what is the message that we're trying to get across and how we're doing it, right? So I think this is a really great sort of corollary conversation of what it means to produce media for different kinds of audiences. Mm-hmm. And really that question of who is it that we're writing for, right? So maybe we can talk a bit about to think with the idea of this process of writing, right? How do you get from idea conception to starting to do it? And then, you know, then we can kind of dive into, as we get down to it, like how you make that audience, you think about, how do you envision the audience you're trying to write for, right? But let's get into the nitty-gritty of like this process first, right? You just sat down and you typed this thing for, I don't know, right?
Right, it's six hours a day.
6 hours a day, right? Nothing else?
That's it, yeah. Right? And in the cold morning light with a cup of tea. I mean, I guess one of the things, initially, I think everyone has this romantic idea of what this process will be. You know, we have these romanticized ideas about writing, about, you know, being visited by a muse or what have you. Uh-huh. And there's such a disconnect between the shiny books we read and then kind of watching ourselves sitting, you know, in the cold morning light, typing literal sort of single words into a Word document.
Right, right.
And having that be a very sort of isolated process with nobody around, no distraction, no nothing, right? And the grind of that and the routine of that and really sort of this idea that you have to establish this routine, you have to come back to that day by day, and there's really nothing sort of glorious about it.
Yeah, so, the dream is there, right? But that's the glorious part, I suppose.
I mean, when you think about the process of this whole production of ethnography, right? You're out there with people, you're having conversations with people, you're working with them. So this process, when you're actually putting together this, you know, work that's supposed to be accessible, it sounds pretty lonely.
Oh, it's extremely lonely.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird echo. You know, it's funny. It made me too, because even you know, writing our dissertations, I'm finding that there's a viscerality to this too, right? There's an embodied experience. I mean, literally, we are embodied, but you know, in certain things, you know, I'm a musician, so I play with my hands a lot, like literally playing keyboards or guitar or something. But when typing dissertation for the past 4 or 5 months, you know, you get really intensive when you're writing, and I found it's like, you know, I don't have carpal tunnel syndrome, but I have thumb pain now, which is weird to me that I've never had before. And it's maybe because I'm older now, I don't know, but it's definitely this weird experience that like there's like literally it's leaving marks on yourself that you're that you're doing this grind, right? So literally, I think grind is kind of the right metaphor.
Yeah.
Or perhaps it's not even a metaphor.
Right, exactly. And also then if we think about moments of inspiration, right, how does that happen?
Right.
And how do you make it happen so that inspiration hits exactly between 8 a.m. and 2 p.m., right?
Right. And is that
which
possible?
Which is when you have the time to write, right, when you're fresh. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just going back quickly to what Ryan said about, you know, how isolating it is, I literally had to put, one of the things I put on my to-do list is, okay, go outside, see other people, interact with human beings, right? Make this like something that becomes part of that writing routine because you drive yourself crazy.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the routine makes such a difference though, you know? And like, I think you're right about this notion of inspiration. It makes me think of this great Charles Dickens quote, right? That he's people say, how did you write so much all the time? Because he had the same strict schedule of writing between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., which is a really, that sounds like a pretty decent life. Minus the fact that it's isolating and that your fingers might break or something. But you know, and he had this funny idea where he said that, you know, how do you be so creative? He's like, well, you know, you have to set the conditions for it, right? He just says that, you know, I don't tell the muse when to come. I just make sure that it can show up between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m. every day. It's like, brilliant.
I think what's interesting about that quote is this is also coming at the later point of Dickens' career, right? So this is when he's had that process down. He kind of understands what he needs to do. So I like to kind of parallel that thought with when Stephen King was writing his first novel, Carrie, right? So he wrote this by hand or on his old typewriter as well, like cooped up in his laundry room in like a trailer park sort of size house, right? Because it was the only place he could escape. He's got this old, heavy, heavy machine just cranked up on his knees, typing away every second you have for a long time, right?
Wow.
This doesn't sound fun. It doesn't sound good. And it doesn't sound productive. And, you know, of course, his writing style has changed over the years drastically. And the way he even goes about writing and thinking about it has totally shifted.
Right. And I think it's interesting because when we hear about, you know, celebrities or politicians coming out with a new book, it always sounds as if they just, you know, had the idea and then they wrote it and it took them a month. And but really, when you think about actual people writing actual books, this is a, you know, it takes at least a year. It takes you coming back to your computer every single day or nearly every single day and really establishing that routine that really feels more like not even tying shoelaces or doing something as mundane as doing the dishes every day. And of course, sometimes, you know, when you're lucky, you find inspiration in those mundane moments of, you know, washing the dishes and then you get an idea.
Right.
But mainly it's you're sitting down and you're waiting the ideas to come to you in a way.
Right.
And they have to come during those times and otherwise. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think again about Stephen King. If you can't tell, I like Stephen King sometimes. But he also keeps a journal by his bed. So every time he wakes up in the morning, he just pulls out the journal, scratches down his dreams, whatever incoherency he pulls out of that, because that's his source of inspiration, right? And this speaks to that sort of, you know, you're doing an activity that doesn't necessarily relate to writing, and then you have your inspiration. It's right there. So for you personally, do you have your computer with you at these times of inspiration?
No, I sometimes take myself to things that I call writing retreats, which are basically basically involve me going somewhere else and writing there.
Okay.
And then maybe going for walks on the beach. I mean, none of those are fancy. or going skiing. I remember the last few three months leading up to the completion of this book, I went up to New Hampshire and I just had to get out. And then I used the times when I would, you know, skate ski through the woods of New Hampshire to think about the relationship between medicine and religion. What could there be said about that? And then I actually went back to the warming hut and got this is so cliche, but I got a bunch of napkins and wrote on the napkins. But it was all really only when my head was really free, and sort of free of the sort of the clutter, that some main ideas came to me, but that's not the norm. The norm is you sit down and you force something out.
Right? Yeah,
right.
It has to come. And it's not a sprint. I mean, another perhaps cliche, perhaps not. It's not a sprint. This writing a book like that is such a marathon. Mm-hmm. And everyone wants to make it seem like a sprint, but it's not. And you have to remember yourself to pace yourself, right? To still retain the enthusiasm, to still retain the inspiration in a way.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. That makes me think of, there's a study that came out in Stanford. And like, people know this, right? But This study is by Marily Apezzo and Daniel Swartz, and they just did a study that found out that walking can improve creativity by over 60% by any person. So just the literally fact of moving and getting up, part of it too is, like you said, washing dishes. I mean, that's sort of one of my Zen things when I'm trying to change my brain, if I'm writing it, because to me it occupies the monkey brain, I like to call it, right? Mm-hmm. Your sort of motor functions, and your higher brain can have a little time to think. That's also when you do good thinking in the shower, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing, but walking's a little better too, because then it adds a little, you know, on top of that. Maybe if you walk in the shower, you'd have double good thinking. I don't know. Put a treadmill in there. But but another author we can think of is Neil Gaiman, the awesome sci-fi fantasy author.
Right.
He has a treadmill desk, and he walks something like 7 miles every day while writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just so he's at his desk, you know, walking, which sounds fun. You know, standing desks are one thing, but then add a, you know, and they might have like those core balls you can sit on also, you know.
Oh, right, yeah.
So, you know, put one of those, but then you can also walk on top of it, like.
Mm-hmm.